Anatomy and Physiology, the Brain and Cranial Nerves, Part 1. This first slide here is mostly meant to wow you. Look at the gross anatomy picture. I love looking at gross anatomy. I hope you're enjoying those too, but this is a human brain at autopsy, obviously. And look at also the functions that the brain has. Truly amazing. Yes, sensations, movements, but also memory, emotions, will, judgment, intellect, decision-making, behavior, and on it goes. I know you guys are all amazed by supercomputers and your iPads and whatever other electronic devices you have. And yeah, they could do a lot of calculations and that kind of stuff and have big memory capacities, but they can't do a lot of these other things on the list, right? Like have emotions and will and judgment. And that reminds me of an old TV series and a movie series that came out called Star Trek. There was this android, his name I think was Data, and he was super smart, of course, and could do all kind of calculations, but one thing he always wanted that he couldn't have was emotions. So yeah, I think we still got the computers beat. And I did a little research on the internet. Apparently there's still one game that human beings can still beat the world's best supercomputers at, and it's a Chinese board game called Go. Check that one out. So yeah, we're still better than computers. Also, I want you to remember on this slide the blood supply to the brain, because it's critical to know if you're going into healthcare. The two major arteries that run up the front of the neck and basically go to the front half of the brain are the internal carotid arteries. The two major arteries that run up the transverse foramen through the vertebral column, basically to the back half-ish of the brain, are called the vertebral arteries. And eventually, remember, they kind of joined up in the circle of Willis at the base of the brain and nourished the brain. So yes, I want you to recall the blood supply, because the brain needs a constant, fresh supply of oxygen and glucose. Your brain does not store glucose. Let me ask you a question. How long would I have to clamp off the arteries to the brain before the brain started having problems, what we call TIA symptoms, like transient problems with speech or transient numbness, transient weakness? It would only take about a minute to do that. That's how dependent the brain is on a fresh supply of blood. What about a stroke? How long would I have to clamp the arteries off to the brain before the patient had a stroke? Essentially, brain cell death. Well, it's approximately 4 or 5 minutes. Now look, when you see patients in the emergency room, and someone comes in and they said, well, my dad here, he had a stroke on the right side of the body. He's been paralyzed over there. It's been about 4 minutes. Don't say, oh, well, Dr. Gonchore said after 4 minutes there's permanent brain damage. There's nothing we can do. That's not what I'm saying. You'll learn the numbers and the timing and the limits, because you don't know exactly how long that blood supply was really interrupted. You don't know if it was complete or partial or a temporary or intermittent interruption. So whether you give clot busters or other drugs or various surgical techniques depends on lots of factors, and you'll learn the appropriate time limits when those things are or are not appropriate, okay? Also, please recall the blood-brain barrier. Does everything that goes through those blood vessels get to the brain cells? And the answer is no, because our old friend, the neuroglial cell called the astrocyte, which I nicknamed the gatekeeper, helped combine with the blood capillaries of the brain to form something called the blood-brain barrier. So not everything that goes through those blood vessels gets to the brain. While I'm thinking about that, I want to give you an example of how the blood-brain barrier can become a little bit weakened. So let me give you an example. Let's say you're the triage nurse in the emergency room and two patients come to see you. And they're both intoxicated. One patient had six shots of straight alcohol. The other patient had six shots of alcohol, but they were mixed in one of those sugary kind of umbrella drinks. Let's say both patients drank the same amount of alcohol in the same amount of time, but one was plain alcohol and the other was the umbrella drinks. Which patient will be intoxicated sooner and more? Well, it's the patient who drank the umbrella drinks. Why? Because sugar actually weakens and loosens up the blood-brain barrier and allows that alcohol to get to the brain cells sooner and more. So yes, you learned something useful in anatomy today. This next slide has to deal with the protective coverings of the brain. We've already done it. They're basically the same as the spinal cord. If I ask you the three things that protect the melon, you will say the bony cranium, the meninges, and the beautiful fluid called the cerebrospinal fluid. The meninges, of course, very similar to the cord. We have the outermost superficial lime green dura mater. We have the middle layer, the spider webby purpley looking layer here called the arachnoid mater. Then the thin layer plastered on the brain like cellophane or shrink wrap called the pia mater with lots of blood vessels in it, please remember. Every once in a while, the dura mater of the brain shown here in this figure will sort of dive into the brain and partially separate it. I really don't consider this too clinically important or too important for lecture. It's more important for lab, and you'll see a couple of these in lab. Let me mention them briefly. The one shown, and the only one shown on this slide, is this extension of dura that divides the two cerebral hemispheres. It's called the Fox cerebri. Fox means a sickle, and cerebri refers to the cerebellum. So the Fox cerebri does sort of sickle the two halves of the brain apart. Root word fox, well, let me describe it. Fox does mean sickle. If you don't know what that is, maybe you've seen pictures of the Grim Reaper. He holds that big wooden handle with a big curved blade on the end. That's called a sickle shape or a sickle blade. Some people call that a sling blade. That reminds me of a true story, by the way. When I was about 5 years old, my dad, he didn't like to mow the lawn, so he let it grow about a month. It would get waist high. Of course, he couldn't cut it. So he would say, Lee, would you mind going out in the garage and getting the sickle, you know, the sling blade, and go slash that back for me a little bit so I can mow the lawn. And I went and did that routinely once a month. I got really good at that. But I kind of think now, if my 7-year-old at home, would I hand him a sling blade? And the answer is no. So I don't know what my dad was thinking. Anyway, it all turned out good in the end, but I'm not sure that was such a good idea. Then there's another extension of dura mater called the Fox cerebelli. That goes right between the two cerebellar hemispheres. It's not really shown good on any pictures in your book, but it's just a little sliver of dura that partially separates the cerebellum in the back. Then we have the tentorium cerebelli. You should see that nicely in the brain lab. Tentorium means tent. Cerebelli means cerebellum. And it does make like a little tent. It's right over the cerebellum. The cerebellum is underneath the tent, and the cerebrum is sitting on top of the tent, so to speak. Now we get to the meat of it. This is just a general overview slide. Don't get nervous or scared on this slide. This shows the principal parts of the brain. This is a great slide to come back to at the end of your studies. Make sure you're organized. Make sure you know the big picture before you dive into the details. Always a great idea. Beautiful gross anatomy picture off to your left. A sagittal section, a medial view, you're kind of looking into it from the right side. And I bet before you took this course, you thought the brain was just this big bowl of fettuccine pasta on the top. Well, the brain is much more than that. It has four major regions. We'll break them down one at a time. Let's just take a look at them shortly on this slide, though. The cerebrum is this big bowl of fettuccine pasta on the top. We'll look at that first. Then we'll take a look at this piece sort of that runs through the middle of the brain called the diencephalon. Di means through, encephalon means brain, and it does go through the middle of the brain. Know your root word encephalon, by the way, because if someone has an encephalitis, that means a brain infection. Then we will look at the brain stem, and last we will look at the fourth major part of the brain that looks like this little bowl of angel hair pasta hanging off the brain stem called the cerebellum. And cerebellum means little brain. So let's take a look. Little intro slide here. We're talking about the cerebrum first. The book says that this is referred to as the seat of intelligence. I've never heard that in my whole life. None of my friends call it that on the weekend, but I just threw it in there. It is separated into right and left halves called cerebral hemispheres. Hemisphere just means half of a sphere. Some more basic anatomy. What your book did here was take a section, sort of a wedge section out of the brain, sucked it out, blew it up in a drawing to your left here. And what it shows is the basic general organization of the brain. Here we have on the outside the darker gray bark of the brain called the cerebral cortex. Remember, cortex means bark. It's the thin outer layer of the cerebrum, only about 2 to 4 millimeters thick, containing 100 billion brain cells. Hard to believe, isn't it? It consists of gray matter. Why is gray matter gray? You should remember, because it's mostly neuron cell bodies, which are stuffed with a lot of rough ER. Deep to that is the white matter. White matter means white myelinated axons. That means these are all the wires running back and forth to those 100 billion brain cells. And those of you who remember the spinal cord are thinking, hey, wait a minute, this is opposite land. And it is. In the spinal cord, the white matter wrapped the gray butterfly, but in the brain, the gray wraps the white. So, yep, it's totally opposite, and I'm just a messenger. So that's the way it is. We'll do some basic surface anatomy on this slide. The noodles of the brain are not called noodles. They are called gyri. That's plural, G-Y-R-I, or singular is gyrus, G-Y-R-U-S. Those are the folds in the cerebrum that are formed from rapid development of the cortex. The way I kind of make an analogy is I think I have a bowl, and I take a big tube of toothpaste, and I squeeze the toothpaste in the bowl really, really, really fast, and that would make it look all noodly, wouldn't it? Well, that's kind of the way the cerebral cortex develops in your skull, I guess. Then we have these shallow grooves or slits between the noodles. Those are called sulci or sulcus is singular. Then there are deep grooves between the folds, and a deep groove in anatomy is a fissure. Believe it or not, someone who had nothing better to do, they gave names to all the slits and all the grooves. The good news is I'm only going to pick on a few of them. The first one I want you to know is the big, long fissure, the deep groove that separates the cerebrum into right and left hemispheres. And that big, long groove is called the longitudinal fissure. The next deep groove I want you to know is this one going crossways here called the transverse fissure that separates the cerebellum below from the cerebrum above. And that is where, by the way, the tentorium cerebelli dove into that deep groove. And I should mention that the fox cerebri is the one that dove into the longitudinal fissure, and that might help you in the lab, by the way. Only one slit that I'm going to pick on, it's the central sulcus. Here it is from a side view. Here it is from a, here it is from a top-down view. Why do I pick on the central sulcus? Because it has a little bit of importance with respect to physiology. The central sulcus divides the frontal lobes in red from the parietal lobes in blue. Why do I pick on that? Because if you remember spinal cord physiology, remember it was sensory information came in the back, motor information came out the front. Same general deal with the brain. We'll see when we study the brain in general. This stuff here behind the central sulcus, mostly sensory stuff. This stuff here in red in front of the central sulcus, mostly motor stuff. So in the brain, same deal. Sensory in the back, motor out the front. Give you a quick example on this slide. Here, of course, is the central sulcus, and somebody called the noodle right in front of the central sulcus the precentral gyrus, and yep, it has motor function. Someone called the noodle behind the central sulcus the postcentral gyrus, and yes, that has sensory function. So that's why I pick on the central sulcus. Let's do a little bit of medial surface anatomy as well. I love this picture again. Sagittal section, medial view of a brain and gross anatomy. We're looking in from the right side. Couple structures I want you to know. The main one is this thick band of white myelinated axons, millions of them, that connect and conduct impulses between the right and left cerebral hemispheres. It's called the corpus callosum. Corpus, if you care, means body. Callus means hard. And it is a rather firm structure if you get to feel in the lab. But this is so key. This lets your right brain talk to your left brain and the left brain talk to the right brain. And really weird things happen if this structure is damaged in some way. If it is damaged due to disease or trauma or genetics or surgery, people develop these interesting academically, syndromes called disconnection syndromes. For example, they might be able to read but not be able to write. Another syndrome I'll tell you about is one I saw in real life. I'll never forget it. It was when I was on the neurology rotation. I went in to see this patient. It was this older woman sitting in a wheelchair. She had her gown on. It was on the right side of her body just fine, but just sort of dangling off the left side of her body. Also, the right side of her hair was brushed. She had makeup on the right side of her face. She had finger polish on her right hand. But the left side of her face, no makeup. Left side of her body, no nail polish. And when I went up to her and I held her right hand in front of her face, I said, "What is this?" She said, "That's my right hand and my right arm." Then I held her left hand and arm in front of her face. I said, "What is this?" She says, "I don't know." She completely denied the left half of her body existed. She didn't take care of it, didn't make up it, didn't brush it, didn't dress it. And there's actually a name for that. It's called left unilateral neglect as a sign of a disconnection syndrome. In other words, because she had a problem with this deal, she totally denied the left half of her body existed. That's a cool one to Google that. There's another structure on this slide called the septum pellucidum. Septum just means a divider. Lucid is a cool Greek root word to know. It means clear. So there's this clear divider between the two lateral ventricles, it's really not clinically significant. You could be born without one, and it really doesn't make a difference. While you're making notes on this slide, I want to talk about something that you don't have to know for this course, but kind of fascinating. Sometimes in the old days, and I don't know if they're still doing it or not, they used to purposely, surgically disconnect patients. In other words, rarely in a certain kind of patient, they would cut the corpus callosum on purpose. It was in patients who had severe seizures that were resistant to all medications known to mankind, and the seizures were so bad that they ended up having multiple injuries every time they had the seizure, and they really had no good lifestyle whatsoever. So by cutting the corpus callosum, by disconnecting them, it limited the seizures to just one half of their body. I know that sounds kind of like a rough procedure to do, but overall, those patients were better off just having those bad seizures on one half of their body than on their whole body. So amazing the way the brain works. If you didn't understand sort of the anatomy on the last slide, here's a cool drawing from your book. It shows the beautiful corpus callosum connecting the two halves of the cerebrum. It also shows the clear divider called the septum pellucidum that I really don't care too much about. Maybe I shouldn't have said that. But anyway, it doesn't have any clinical significance to me. Now we get to the meat. We're going to talk about the lobes of the cerebrum, and we're going to talk about the functional organization of the cerebral cortex. In other words, with each of the four lobes of the brain, I'm going to pick out a couple of noodles. We're going to learn exactly what they do for the human body. So here's the overview. We got four lobes of the brain, and the good news is they're named for the bones that are sitting on top of them that you probably already know. In red, we have in the front, the frontal lobes. Over here in blue, we have the parietal lobes, kind of the upper sides of your head. In the very back, in green, we have the occipital lobes. And then on the lower sides of your head, exactly where the temporal bones were, of course, we have the temporal lobes. So let's go ahead and break it down. First, I want to look at the frontal lobe. Don't get nervous on the slide. I'm not going to show you a picture of the brain and ask you to pick off, you know, all the different areas. And yeah, someone who had nothing better to do, they named every single one of these noodles, but I'm only going to pick on my favorites. And I do have five favorites in the frontal lobe. This is just a list slide. We'll look at them one at a time in that order, so just calm down. The good news is each of those words really does help us with either function or maybe location. So let's look at them one at a time in this order, starting with the primary motor area. Primary, whenever you see the word primary, it just means kind of the main basic area. It's a very kind of simple area of the brain, so to speak. And the primary motor area is just the main basic simple motor area of the cerebral cortex. Where's it located? We already kind of did it. It's in the precentral gyrus of the frontal lobe. What does it do? It controls basic, simple, voluntary movements of skeletal muscles on the opposite side of the body. I bet you already knew that, that the right brain generally controls the left body and the left brain generally controls the right body. So that what? If on the test I said your patient has a stroke of the right primary motor area, which part of the body is paralyzed, you will say the left side. What does this area do? Let me give you an example, because no better way to understand these areas by example. This area allows me just to maybe go over to the desk and pick up a pencil off the desk. It's not a very complicated area. Even a little baby can go over and pick, you know, something up off the floor, for example. as opposed to this next area called the premotor area. Look at the name, it helps you. It is a motor area. Pre means in front of, and the premotor area is just in front of the primary motor area. It connects to it. It talks to it. It helps it. It communicates with the primary motor area. This is known as a motor association area. Underline it, highlight it, star it. It's our first association areas. In general, whenever you see the word association area, it means a much more complex area of the brain. Maybe it has to do with memories or behaviors or learned skills or emotions. It's a complicated area of the brain. Again, connects to, talks to, works with, and helps out the basic primary area. So that what? So that this complex area allows me now not just to pick up the pencil, but to actually write some notes on the pages I have in front of me. And my one-year-old, remember, he could pick up the pencil with his primary area, but he doesn't have the skill set yet to actually write words down on a page. So that's what the premotor area allows you to do. That's a great noodle. Then comes the frontal eye field, which is right there on your picture. Let the words help you. It's in the frontal lobe. So you're thinking to yourself, it's in the front. What does that mean? Motor or sensory? And hopefully you're going to say motor because motor's in the front. Eyes mean to eyes. So maybe you guess that the frontal eye field's going to move to eyes. And you would be right. This is another motor association area. That means it deals with complex functions. For example, as you scan your eyeballs across the notes on your page, that's a complicated deal. Reading sentences, scanning your eyes is a complicated process. My one-year-old, you know, he could move his eyeballs kind of willy-nilly randomly here and there, but he sure doesn't have the ability to scan very carefully words on a page that will eventually allow him to read sentences. So this is a complicated association area. Another thing that's beyond the scope of this course, kind of fascinating, you kind of tuck it off to the side, but as you get more advanced, you'll learn that the right frontal eye field allows your eyes to scan to the left. Your left frontal eye field allows your eyeballs to scan to the right. So what? Well, they taught me very simple, something very simple in medical school that works every time. If someone comes into you into the emergency room and they say, hey, my eyeballs, they're stuck to the right side, and you ask them to move their eyeballs and they can't move them a lick to the left, they're just frozen to the right, I knew automatically they had a stroke or maybe a tumor of the right frontal eye field, because it just so turns out you always look at the lesion, or your patients always look at the lesion. So if the patient looked to the right, I could act like I was real smart to the radiologist. I would say, get an MRI scan, pay attention to that right frontal eye field. That's where you're going to find the stroke. And sure enough, it works every time. And this brings me to something else. I love the brain. The brain was so cool. I wanted to be a neurologist. As you study these pieces and parts, I know it's a lot of stuff, but it's just so logical the way it all fits together. And in neurology, if you know your stuff, you can really figure it out just by taking a good history and physical. So I love the brain. I love neurology. Now we'll do Broca's speech area, and I'm guessing you're going to think it has something to do with speech, and you would be right. In your book, it's showing Broca's speech area right here in the frontal lobe. The problem is the book made a mistake, because in almost all individuals, it just so turns out that Broca's speech area, I want you to know, is in the left cerebral hemisphere. This is a motor area that regulates the muscles that allow us to talk. So this is the part of the brain, these are the noodles, that allow us to move the muscles so we can speak. So that what? If on the test I give a stroke to Broca's speech area, which is generally in the left frontal lobe, they won't be able to talk. For example, maybe a daughter will bring her dad in to see you in the ER and say, my dad was fine until about 5 minutes ago, and then something went wrong. And you say, hey, Mr. Jones, how you doing today? And he says, In other words, he can't talk. And the way I remember it is, if I ruin Broca's speech area on the test with a stroke or a tumor, I break their speech. That's right. If this area is damaged, Broca's speech area, you break their speech. People who have problems with stuttering, this is the area of the brain that has been implicated in that disorder. What about the right cerebral hemisphere? You're saying, wait a minute, if Broca's speech area is on the left side, what's on the right side? Is there just a big, you know, a big cyst here, just a big gaping hole in my head? Of course not. There are noodles there, and those are the noodles that put emotion into our speech. So that is what's interesting about the right side. You may have heard that the right brain is sort of the emotional, music, artsy side of the brain, and it is. We'll talk about that more. So Broca's speech area is on the left side. The noodles on the right side just inject emotion into our speech. So that what? If I stroke out these noodles on the right frontal lobe that correspond to Broca's speech area on the left side, the patient can still talk, but they'll talk very monotone with no emotions whatsoever. Their speech will be very kind of flat, so to speak. This area, unfortunately, is a common area to get a stroke. It doesn't have a great blood supply. If someone comes to see you, let's say they don't have anybody with them, they're just brought in by the ambulance, and of course, first you're going to do all your emergency care, all your life-saving care, whatever your treatment's going to be, and your brain scans and whatever. But then you're going to have some time maybe to try to take a history and physical, but they have nobody with them. How can you communicate with this patient? After all, you're going to want to find out what drugs they're on, what allergies they have. What can they do? They can still write, can't they? So that's the way you can communicate with these patients, because they can hear you, they can understand you, they just can't vocalize, they can't talk, but they'll be able to communicate with you by writing things down. Don't forget that, please. Then comes the prefrontal cortex. I used to leave this out. I can't believe I ever did that, as a matter of fact. I love this part of the brain. Yes, it's in the frontal lobe. It's buried deep inside here. You can't see it. It is an association area. That means it's a really complex area. It's very large, located in the anterior or front portion of the frontal lobe, as the name tells you, prefrontal cortex. This is what makes us us. This is what gives us our personality, intellect, judgment, reasoning, mood, emotions, intuition. This is what separates us from most other animals. Primates tend to have this area fairly well developed, but no animal on earth has it more well developed than human beings. And in the old days, you may have heard of this. It's kind of a barbaric procedure. If somebody had a severe type of a psychiatric disorder that was totally resistant to medications, they actually did something in the old days called a frontal lobotomy. You may have heard of that. That's where they go in and take out this part of the brain. And it left the patient kind of emotionless. But I guess back then they thought that was better than whatever severe psychiatric illness that they had was. Now we'll move on to the parietal lobe. I'll pick out four areas of the parietal lobe. Here they are. This is just the list slide. Let's look at them one at a time in order. But they generally tell us something about where they are or what they do. The first area I want to look at is the primary somatosensory area. Let's break down the words. Primary, remember, just means the main, basic, simple spot. Soma means body, sense means to sense. So this is just the main body, basic, simple, sensing noodle. Where is it located? It's located in our old friend, the post-central gyrus of the parietal lobe. What does it do? Look what it says here. I'm going to break this down. It receives impulses for touch, proprioception, itch, tickle, pain, temperature, and so on. Just basic body senses. Remember our old sense, proprioception? Proprioception, recall, is the ability to perceive the position and movement of our parts in space. So when I'm on the dance floor swinging my arm over my head, even with my eyes closed, I know where my muscles and joints and parts are because of my sense called proprioception. But look, this sensory noodle, like many other sensory areas of the cerebral cortex, not only can it receive those impulses, it can perceive those impulses. And you should know what a definition of perception is. Perception is the conscious awareness and interpretation of the sensation. Let me give an example. In the third grade, I'll never forget this. The guy who sat behind me, I still remember his name, I won't say it now. He taped a little sign on my back. And what did the sign say? It said, "You got it, kick me." And I walked around all day in the third grade with a kick me sign on my back. Now, what's the deal? Did I maybe receive some impulses for touch when he gently taped that sign on my back? Probably did. A few sensory impulses probably were received by this noodle. But did I perceive it? Was I consciously aware that he taped it to my back? And the answer is no. So we don't always perceive what we receive is the point. So let me give you an example of what this primary noodle can do. If I pick up this PowerPoint presenter off the desk, all this noodle can do is tell me, well, it's kind of hard, it feels a little cool to the touch, kind of has maybe an oval shape to it. You know, that's really the best this noodle can do. It's a basic noodle. What about the next noodle? The somatosensory association area. That means body sensing, more complicated spot. Look where it is, and this is a recurrent theme. It's right next to the primary area. Connects to, talks to, communicates with, helps the main area. So here it is, just behind the primary area we discussed. What does this association area allow us to do? It allows us to recognize objects by touch without even looking at them. Again, this is a complicated area that depends on things like memories. So that what? So that now when I pick up the PowerPoint presenter off the table, my primary area just says it's, you know, oval and hard and cool. But my association area says, even with my eyes closed, this is a PowerPoint presenter. That's the difference between an association and a primary area. That's the power of the association area. Another example that I think your book might give to try to make this sink in. Say you go to a barbecue, right? The first 10 times you go to the barbecue, you feel a little tickle on your arm, then you feel a pinch, then you look down and see a speck of blood and a mosquito, then you smack it. Then the 11th time you go to the barbecue, this noodle kind of kicks in. Because when the mosquito first lands on your arm and you feel that little tickle, don't you find yourself smacking it before you get the bite and the blood? That's an example of this complicated area that relies on memories coming into action. And maybe this is a good place to write this down. Mom was going to ask you, since you've taken this course, saying, okay, you know, since you're taking this course, you got to be real smart. Can you tell me where my memory banks are? Well, one of the main places where memories are stored in general are the association areas. So mark that down. Association areas are one of our memory banks, so to speak. The next area we're going to check out, I love this area, it's called Wernicke's area. Wernicke's area is located, yes, in the parietal lobe, but it's so big, it's also located in the temporal lobes as well. In the left cerebral hemisphere, your book made a mistake. This language area is also, in almost all of us, located on the left side. Wernicke's area. How does this help me remember where it is? I remember W for Wernicke's, double location. So W for Wernicke, it has a double location. It's the only area that we'll talk about in my course that has a double location. It's in both the parietal and the temporal lobes. It is absolutely an association area. It's a very complicated spot. Look what it does. It enables us to understand the spoken word. So here's the example. Maybe a daughter's watching a football game on Saturday with her dad. Then all of a sudden, something bad goes wrong. She brings her dad into the emergency room, and you're the triage nurse or maybe the doctor, and the daughter says, something's wrong with my dad. He was fine, you know, 10 minutes ago, but now something bad's wrong. So you go to Mr. Jones and you say, Mr. Jones, how you doing today? And he says, Tree Pepsi Disco Dance. And you're like, uh-oh, yep, something bad went wrong. Now, when you first hear it, it sounds almost kind of funny, but don't laugh. Everyone knows something bad's wrong. Everyone knows probably the patient had a stroke. But they do talk like that. Your book says they talk in a word salad. I like that too, because Wernicke's has a W. Wernicke's people talk with word salad. They just mix a whole bunch of words together. In other words, can they hear you? Yes. Can they talk? Yes. But do they understand what you said to them? No. So the words they say, they string together a whole bunch of words, but they don't make any sense at all because they don't understand you. They speak in what's called a word salad. Another example I like to give is I refer to this area as the teenage brain. Now, don't take that in the wrong way. It's just an example, okay? It's not meant to offend anybody. A lot of you might be teenagers. But I've raised some teenagers, and here's the deal. My teenager, when I talk to her, can she hear me? Yeah, she can probably hear me. Can she talk? Yep, she talks. Oh, yeah. Talk. Does she make any sense to me when she talks? Not really. Why? Because I don't think she understands a word I'm saying to her. So maybe that's another way to remember Wernicke's area. Maybe think of it as the teenage brain. What's fascinating academically about these patients is that when you talk to them, they can't understand the spoken word. But supposedly, they can understand a song. Because what's over here on the right side of the brain? Just a big old cyst or a big old gaping hole? No. The corresponding noodles on the right side of the brain are the noodles that have to do with emotion. Again, the right side of the brain is music, art, and emotion. So I've never seen this, but there's lots in the literature where you can actually sing to the patient and supposedly they can understand that. Or they can sing to themselves and understand what they're singing. It's sort of the same thing we're talking about with Broca's area. They could maybe not talk, or maybe they have a stuttering problem, but they can sing. Same deal here, supposedly. They can't understand the spoken word, but supposedly they can understand if you sing to them. I only buy that if it's a song they already know and are familiar with. I don't believe they can understand a song that they don't already have stored somewhere in their memory bank, so to speak. In other words, I do not believe at all it's possible to go to Mr. Jones and say, Mr. Jones, how are you today? What are you allergic to, please? Can you tell me? In other words, you can't sing them the history. I don't believe that they could answer those questions. But it is fascinating to know that they can understand a song they sing to themselves or they hear if it's a song they're well familiar with that's stored in their memory banks. Which brings me to something else fascinating, just so fascinating to me. When you try to rehabilitate stroke patients who have strokes to their language areas, one of the ways you rehabilitate them and help them get better is by something called singing therapy. That's right. If you sing to a patient who has a stroke to these language areas we've been talking about, what they do is they rewire their circuits to the right side of the brain, because that's the emotion, music, art part of the brain. And there's articles about it. It is real. You can sing to these patients and rehabilitate them that way. And furthermore, they say that women or female patients can recover faster than male patients using singing therapy. And you may have heard that women are more right brain than left brain. I'm not saying that's true or not, but that's the, you know, one of the theories, that women have a better sort of music, art, emotion half of the brain on the right side, so that they recover quicker and better. They rewire better to that right brain when you sing to them. Fascinating part of the brain. Now we have the primary gustatory area. Let's break down the words. Primary just means main, basic. Gustatory refers to the sense of taste. So it's the main taste spot. Here it is shown in the parietal lobe, and I really have nothing more to say about it. It's just the main basic area which receives impulses for taste. How do I remember it? Because I know there's lots of stuff to remember it. I just remember I can't taste grandma's apple pie without the parietal lobe. You get it? Parietal lobe, parietal lobe. I know that sounds silly, but that may come back to help you later on. The primary gustatory area is in the parietal lobe. Now we have the occipital lobe, and you could probably already tell already what's going on in the occipital lobe. Two basic areas, and the names tell you exactly what they do. So we'll talk about these two areas back here in green. First, starting with the primary visual area, it's just the main seeing spot. In other words, it's just the main area that receives basic visual information. It's a simple area. If I look out the window in the parking lot, I see something that's red and it's shiny and it's kind of a rectangular shape. It's got some black circles on it. But that's all that I can really tell with my primary visual area. Then comes the visual association area. That means the vision complicated area, something that relies on something you learned or memories or what have you. Notice the recurring theme. It is right next to, talks to, connects to, communicates with, and helps the primary area. So that what? So now I look out in the parking lot and I say, oh, that's a Mustang GT. You see the difference between the primary simple area and the visual association area? Let's wrap up this section with the temporal lobe. The temporal lobe has three basic areas I want you to know. And again, now that you have a little knowledge, I bet you can figure out what all these do without even looking at the slides. Here we go, first with the primary auditory area. It's just the main basic simple hearing spot. Here it is, located on the temporal lobe, shown here in sort of a greenish color in this diagram. It's just the basic spot that receives basic information for sound. In other words, when I'm listening to my iPod, all this area can do is detect maybe the rhythm, the pitch, and the intensity of the sound. That's all it can do. It's a very simple spot. As opposed to the auditory association area. That means hearing more complicated spot. Again, a common theme. Located right next to, talks to, communicates with, and helps out the basic spot. So that what? So that now with my iPod in my ears, what can I do? I can say to myself, oh, that's Lady Gaga, that's Flo Rida, that's Pink, that's Lil Wayne, that's Justin Bieber. No, I don't have all those in my iPad. I mean my iPod. Actually, I do have all of my iPod except one. Guess which one? Justin Bieber. No, I do not have Justin Bieber in my iPod. Finally, we have the primary olfactory area. You can't really see it on this picture because it's deep inside the temporal lobe. You probably know what it does already by the words. It's the main basic smell spot. Just receives basic information for smell. Before I end this unit, I want to talk about the temporal lobe. And I want you to know this. Write it down. Because you will see patients with seizures. Most seizures by far start in the temporal lobe. They can come from other lobes as well. Some people have nighttime seizures. Nighttime seizures, interestingly, usually come from the frontal lobe, and they're classically described as looking like they're riding a bicycle while they're sleeping. That's a sign of a frontal lobe seizure. But most seizures occur in the temporal lobe, so I want to talk about those in a little bit of detail. What's a seizure? A seizure usually means that one of the brain cells mistakenly starts to fire off its electricity, right? Action potentials. And then eventually that electricity keeps spreading and spreading to other surrounding cells. For example, eventually maybe gets to the motor noodles on one side, then one side of the body starts shaking, then it spreads over to the other side and the whole body might start shaking. That's, you know, a general kind of a seizure. The interesting thing is, since most seizures start in the temporal lobe, that people who have a seizure will often first either hear something or smell something just before the seizure. It's called an aura. In other words, they have kind of a warning. And usually it's the same exact thing. Like they'll smell bacon. And then a couple minutes after they smell bacon, they'll have their seizure, and then they'll wake up with whatever, gashes and broken bones. And the interesting thing is, you know, after about the 10th time of smelling bacon and waking up on the floor with bruises and bumps, you'll notice that those patients, they'll have that smell of bacon or whatever, then they'll go lay themselves down in the most open area of the room or outside in a field, and they'll lay down and have their seizure, hopefully without any injuries. Because they learn that every time they smell the bacon or hear a certain sound, they're going to have a seizure. And you'll see that. Some of you might have heard of that. Not only that, but those sounds or smells can actually trigger the seizure. So if they smell bacon cooking, that might throw them into a seizure. I have an easy way also for you to remember that both hearing and smell are in the temporal lobe. Of course, your ears are right over the temporal lobe, so it's easy to remember hearing is in the temporal lobe noodles. And then I want you to have a corny visual in your head because that helps things stick. I want you to grow a nose out of your ears. So have that visual of growing a nose out of your ears, and you'll remember that smell is also located in the temporal lobes. There's nothing really new on this slide. I just love the association ear areas. I think you've seen there's a common recurring theme here that every time we talked about an association of the association area of the cerebral cortex, it dealt with something much more complex that maybe was hooked to memory, emotions, learned or skilled behaviors, or what have you. So I love the association areas. And this last slide I think I have is kind of just for you. What they did was they laid out a drawing of the cerebral cortex. Over to your left, they're trying to show the sensory areas in blue. Over to your right, the motor areas in red. And the whole point is this. Do you think there's the same exact amount of brain cells dedicated to each area of the body evenly? And the answer, of course, is no. All this picture is showing you is there's much more brain cells devoted, say, to your hand and your face than to your elbow and your knee. And it makes sense. I mean, you don't need a lot of neurons to do your knee as opposed to all the complicated things in your face and hands, for example.